Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Anna Magnuson, and I'll be one of your co-hosts for the next hour. With me is Mike Murphy, superstar engineer of Local Talk, and he'll be helping us as well. So thank you for joining in to listen today. So, Mike Murphy, what is the weather today? It seems very bitterly cold today, and I'm sure there's lots of closings.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. Maybe we should look to pull those up. But what I can tell you is it's scheduled a high of 3 degrees today, and I think we're at zero now, and 37% chance of precipitation. And if it's this cold, it's not going to be rain. So another day to bundle up and avoid going out if you can. Or if you're going to be out, keep it to very minimal amount of time.
Yes, and please watch those pets out there. Don't take them out too long in this very, very cold weather. So stay warm, everybody. Now let's welcome Dennis Hart, a master at gathering the news for this week from the pages of the Ames Tribune.
The coronavirus and its effects continued making big news around Iowa last week, but we'll begin first with the blizzard that blew its way through last Thursday and brought with it low temperatures that will continue through this week. The storm dropped several inches of snow in central Iowa on Thursday. The 3 inches that fell at the Des Moines airport brought the season's snowfall total there to more than 43 inches, 21 inches above normal. And in the wake of that snow, more than 40 vehicles piled up on Interstate 80 west of Newton. Traffic was backed up for miles, and eastbound lanes were closed for hours. Several drivers were injured. Dozens of other crashes took place around the state. And in eastern Iowa, Animal Rescue League officials said their emergency response teams rescued more than 40 dogs that had been confined in pens with only 2 rundown buildings and a camper as shelter during the blizzard. Now, the coronavirus. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said late last week that the state's limited mask and social distancing requirements would be lifted, starting yesterday. In a press release, the governor encouraged state residents, businesses, and organizations to take reasonable public health measures. After the governor's announcement, Des Moines Mayor Frank County said that his city's mask mandate would remain in place. County said the governor's decision was confusing and could not be rationalized with the number of coronavirus cases across the state and in Polk County. This as the death toll from the virus continued to go up around the state, exceeding 5,100 by yesterday afternoon. And the number of people infected in Iowa by the virus also continued to rise, approaching 325,000 by yesterday. Both numbers were going up slower than they had been. Meanwhile, there was word that Iowa U.S. Congresswoman Cindy Axne had gone into quarantine last week after one of her staff members had tested positive for the coronavirus. Earlier, Axne had received her first dose of the coronavirus vaccine. And in the Iowa House of Representatives, 7 Democratic members were not able to take part in legislative business because they were either in quarantine or had tested positive for the virus or were considered high risk. And there was word that a new, more transmissible version of the virus had been found in Iowa. The variant was first detected in the United Kingdom last year. 3 Iowans had been confirmed to have it, 2 in Johnson County and 1 in Bremer County. Among Iowa's neighbors, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota each had confirmed the variant's presence. Governor Reynolds said last week that she had been pressing federal officials about why Iowa is receiving fewer vaccine doses than other states. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported Iowa had received more than 445,000 doses. Meanwhile, the state expanded its eligibility requirements for the coronavirus vaccine last Monday. Starting then, more than 660,000 state residents became eligible to get the vaccine, about 20% of Iowa's population. Starting last Monday, anyone 65 years old or older became eligible for the vaccine, as did law enforcement, firefighters, child welfare workers, and other emergency responders. In addition, educators up to the high school level and other child care workers became eligible. The Des Moines Register reported that hundreds of central Iowa teachers would receive their first doses of the coronavirus vaccine last week. Each school or school district was handling the vaccination availability differently. The Des Moines Public School District held a vaccination clinic this past Saturday at Mercy One Des Moines Medical Center to vaccinate about 500 of its employees. The Ames School District held a vaccination clinic this past Friday. Meanwhile, the presidents of Iowa's 3 major public universities said they needed more money this coming year to offset what they said was more than $165 million in coronavirus-related losses. The University of Iowa reported $83 million in losses, Iowa State University reported $49 million, and the University of Northern Iowa reported $35 million in losses. Also last week, word that courthouses around the state were gearing up for their first jury trials in nearly a year. Iowa paused all jury trials last March as the coronavirus pandemic swept across the state. Trials resumed again in September with new social distancing protocols in place, but were suspended again in November as virus infection spiked again. And one more coronavirus-related note, word last week that a Cedar Rapids dog had become the first animal diagnosed with the coronavirus in Iowa. Steve Shriver and his family contracted the virus and were staying home recovering when they noticed their dog, named Eden, was constantly coughing. They got Eden tested and found that she had the virus. The dog is recovering. In other news last week, Governor Reynolds released a proposed criminal justice bill. Among other things, it would ban racial profiling by police, increase penalties for some offenses, and deny state funding to cities and counties that cut police budgets. It would also let officers who suffer injuries while performing their duties sue people, groups and organizations or corporations who injured them. The proposal combines Reynolds' effort to build on a police officer accountability law she signed last year during a summer of protest for racial justice, with pro-law enforcement measures Republicans championed during last year's election. The governor also released a plan to fill a growing gap in the state's supply of affordable housing. The plan relies mainly on tax credits to expand revenue that developers could use to drive down the cost of financing construction and keep rents and mortgages lower than typical market rates. Her plan would fund housing for low-income Iowans and has provisions intended to help ensure that housing costs are not too much for others in the state's workforce. A recent study showed that the state needs 47,000 more homes in the next decade to accommodate population growth. Meanwhile, in the state Senate last week, a subcommittee advanced a bill that would let landlords reject renters who want to pay with federal rent vouchers. That legislation would ban future city ordinances and get rid of any on the books now that prohibit landlords from rejecting tenants based on their use of Section 8 certificates. The legislation would scrap ordinances in Des Moines and Iowa City that ban housing discrimination based on source of income. In the Iowa House of Representatives last week, a subcommittee advanced a bill that would prohibit Iowa's public colleges and universities from requiring students or staff to wear face masks or social distance to protect against the coronavirus while those students or staff members are off campus. The bill also would ban accredited private institutions that have similar off-campus requirements from receiving state funding through the Iowa Tuition Grant Program. Also last week, a bill that would have given the state legislature the authority to overturn certain state Supreme Court rulings stalled when it could not get enough votes to advance in the state House. And last week, Iowa Republican House Speaker Pat Grassley refused to let Democratic Representative Beth Wessel Crochelle of Ames speak during a floor debate because she was violating the House dress code. She was wearing jeans in violation of that dress code. She did that intentionally to protest the House's lack of mask-wearing rules. Still on politics, but this time on the national level, word last week that Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst had criticized the views of controversial Republican U.S. House member Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. Ernst said that Greene does not represent the Republican Party and that she, Ernst, did not want her to be the face of the party. Among other things, Greene has supported the conspiracy theory QAnon and posted likes on social media posts calling for violence against prominent Democrats, as well as a conspiracy theory claiming a space laser started deadly wildfires in California. Late last week, the House of Representatives voted to strip Greene of her committee assignments. There was also word that the state Supreme Court would hear arguments on February 16th from state officials who are seeking to block an auditor's subpoena for records on a big financial transaction involving the University of Iowa. The Des Moines Register reported that the case was brought by the Iowa Board of Regents, which is asking the court to deem invalid a subpoena issued by state auditor Rob Sand. The issue involves a deal awarding two French companies a 50-year contract to operate the University of Iowa's utility system. Meanwhile, last week, word that the Clarinda Academy, a youth facility in southwest Iowa that has been the focus of multiple investigations into the alleged abuse and rape of troubled teens, would be shutting down. The Alabama-based company that runs the academy did not explain why it would close. In another story, word that Iowa would receive nearly $5 million over 5 years as part of a multi-state settlement with a firm that worked with opioid manufacturers to promote addictive painkillers. The settlement money from McKinsey & Company will be used to address problems caused by opioids, including paying for substance abuse services for Iowans. In Des Moines last week, word that the city would soon own an 11-story parking garage and the undeveloped land around it that are part of a downtown project called The Fifth. The city council approved a purchase agreement on Wednesday. That agreement does not end the legal battle between the city and the project's former developers. The city had filed a lawsuit against them for their failure to meet deadlines for the project, which called for a 40-story hotel and apartment tower and a theater complex and parking garage. The developers have also sued the city of Des Moines. Still in Des Moines, word last week that plans for a professional soccer stadium downtown had ballooned into a mixed-use project with more than 800 apartments, shopping, offices, and two hotels across two neighborhoods in the city's core. The commercial real estate arm of Come and Go's parent company, the Krauss Group, is now proposing to spend $550 million for construction and renovation in a 2-million-square-foot expanse on the western edge of downtown. And there was word that a group was trying to raise $3 million to bring back the Varsity Cinema in Des Moines. The Des Moines Film Society kicked off its campaign last Monday to raise money for the project, which would transform the one-screen theater on 25th Street into a modern cinema and film center. That includes adding new seats, expanding the lobby, and adding a second screen upstairs, making it a micro-cinema with about 50 seats. The theater has been a Drake neighborhood staple since it opened on Christmas Day in 1938. The building it's in dates back to 1917, and originally was an auto garage. And that is your summary of a busy, busy week of news from all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, catching my breath after all this, but planning to return to this same virtual seat on Friday, when I'll report on what's been making news in Ames. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.
There's nothing quite like a cardinal in the snow. All that white and God's splash of red, as if he had said, here is my thought for the day. A cardinal in the snow, oh, a cardinal in the snow, a cardinal in the snow. Bird in my window, more magnificent than the mountains, more beautiful than the valleys and the rivers and the wonders of this world. Bird in my window, only for a second or two, into the scrapbook of my being. Oh dear God, thanks for making it so. He's even more beautiful than Marilyn Monroe. This cardinal in the snow, even more so than the willow tree, even more so than Van Gogh. Family name. He's
And that was Dennis Hart with the news, followed by the fabulous Peter Link with Cardinal in the Snow, sung about one of the great pleasures in life that we have here this time of year. I'm also hearing the Cardinal sing these days. I grew up learning that the Cardinal's mating season began Valentine's Day, thus his song begins, which is a romantic notion befitting that beautiful bird. However, I have already started hearing the Cardinal pretty promptly on February 1st, a most welcome sound. I hope you're able to enjoy the beautiful sight and sound of the Cardinal as well. Both are like jewels brightening the last grueling days of winter, and they are grueling. I'm Ursula Rudenberg. This is Local Talk, and I'm your host for the hour. I thank Michael Murphy for starting the show. I started my day out stuck in a snowdrift, so not only is there a Cardinal in the snow, but there's a Corolla in the snow now, too. February has started, and this is a significant month for ACCESS, the Assault Care Center extending shelter and support. The regional nonprofit organization that helps survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and other types of violence. The organization started out as one telephone line here in Ames and has grown into an organization serving several counties in central Iowa. This month, ACCESS is celebrating its 45th anniversary, and congratulations on a great story in the Tribune as well to kick off the month. To celebrate this, ACCESS is commemorating historical landmarks and people who made this organization possible with an oral history project called Accessing Our History. KHOI and ACCESS staff have been recording testimonials from people involved with ACCESS throughout the years, and we're pleased to share some of this in a three-part series here on Local Talk. Tess Cody, the executive director of ACCESS, and Courtney Palmersheim, the development coordinator and the producer of the History Project, were here last month to introduce the project, and we talked a little bit about the most central part of the work of the organization, the work of the advocates. Today, Courtney has returned for a second installment in the series. Welcome back, Courtney. And it's good to have you back. Courtney, again, is the development coordinator and producer for Accessing Our History Project. Briefly, before we get into the project, Courtney, please describe again exactly what ACCESS is and what you do, just in case somebody's listening that doesn't know you.
Thanks for having me back again. So ACCESS provides free confidential services to victims of domestic and sexual violence, as well as homicide and other violent crimes. ACCESS can provide a wider range of services. Really what ACCESS advocates do is listen to the person, inform them of all of their options, and support them in the path that that they choose to go down. Just to name a few things that ACCESS can help with, ACCESS has 24/7 helplines. It can provide guidance through the court system, as well as other systems like the university and healthcare systems. ACCESS can help find stable housing, and ACCESS advocates can also just simply listen to you and hear your story.
Thank you. And you're developing a page on your website for this project, right, for this history project?
Yep. So our website is assaultcarecenter.org. And we wanted to make sure that everything accessing our history has a place to live publicly so that anyone can read and listen to the amazing stories that we've been collecting. You can find that on our website by hitting donate in the upper right-hand corner, and then you'll see a tab called Accessing Our History. And there lives all the stories, upcoming events, and ways to be involved with our project.
Okay, thank you. And before we get started, to you, the listener, just please be advised that this conversation involves topics of sexual assault and domestic violence, which can trigger emotional responses. So, Courtney, tell us a little bit about Local Talk's installment today of Accessing Our History Project.
Yeah, thank you, Ursula. It's good to be back. Today, we want to go back to the beginning of Access back in the 1970s. You, Ursula Rudenberg, founded Access in 1976 and served as its first paid coordinator. Ursula's reasoning for doing this were based in her own need for rape crisis services in Ames after she herself experienced being raped. Not finding any services in this area, Ursula set out to establish a service for her own well-being, not knowing that her actions would have ripple effects on survivors for years and years to come. Here's an excerpt from what you told us when we recorded you, Ursula.
So by necessity, I ended up, you know, figuring out how to do it because I just needed to have a rape crisis center in my vicinity, and there was none. And so making it was better than not having one at all. It wasn't a hugely altruistic thing. You know, my idea wasn't I'm going to go into Ames, Iowa and, you know, establish a service that isn't there for the better public. I don't think that thought crossed my mind. I just needed to have a rape crisis center around, and this was the only way that I could get one.
What we heard here from you, Ursula, and from others was about bravery and perseverance that were needed at the beginning to push through the societal norms of the time, and that it was necessary to really take risks and to be a leader in a climate where the people around you didn't believe violence against women was real or that any organization was needed to address violence against women.
So, Courtney, you brought a guest with you today. Could you introduce who you brought?
Yeah, so I have Lynn Koch here. She is our volunteer and intern program coordinator. Thank you so much for joining us, Lynn.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so the clip we just heard about Ursula is about how she founded Access on the basis of Ames not having any resources for violent survivors. Do you think now in 2020 that Ames has enough resources for survivors?
You know, that's such a loaded question because I think there's so much more than there was, but I still think there's always room for growth. You know, we have great collaborations within the community, but I think our biggest strength and sometimes our biggest weakness is our community. And by that, I mean it's individuals. We need individuals who believe victims, who support victims, who aren't afraid to speak out in that support. A lot of times, we see the support through donations. We see the support through community posts, community activism, awareness opportunities, which is wonderful because it speaks to the victim themselves. And in that voice, I think that's the support that the victims need the most.
Definitely. Thank you. So when Ursula started Access as a nonprofit organization, she needed a mentor. She found this in George Belitzos, the founder and former executive director of Youth and Shelter Services. George was able to give her advice since he himself had gone through some similar experiences when he introduced YSS, also a new human service built to meet a need in our community. In this clip, George describes how there was less awareness about the need for human services in the 1970s.
There was a lot of realization at that time in Ames that the city has its head in the sand as far as the problems of young people. Women were just, for the first time, getting recognized as people who count, and women's consciousness raising was just blooming. And this, the springboard for all this was the Vietnam War, and people, you know, this was at the tail end, and people were organizing, people were talking about problems in their own community for the first time, and it was being recognized, just like the runaway and homeless youth that I was serving. Women at that time in particular and LGBT people were it didn't count for much. And the struggles that we went through ourselves, or that women, you know, as second-class citizens, the same for LGBT people, we were much more sensitive to what was going on in our country and in our environment and in our city. And there was a lot of anger at that time. And these are people who, instead of being angry, said, let's do something to make this better.
So that was George Bellitzos, founder and former executive director of Youth and Shelter Services, speaking about Central Iowa in the 1970s, when awareness about the need for numerous social services was still just in the fledgling stage. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here today with Courtney Palmersheim from Access. She's a development coordinator, and she's the producer of a history project that is being conducted by Access this year, celebrating the 45th anniversary of the organization. And with her is Lynn Kott, a volunteer and intern coordinator for Access. Courtney?
Yeah, so we have been playing clips from oral testimonials taken from people who have worked at Access throughout the years. Access and KHOI partner to make these recordings here in the KHOI studio. So, Lynn, when Ursula was working on founding the incorporated organization that is now known as Access, George Bellitzos partnered with her to give her advice on how to create a new and needed service in the community. Can you speak to the value of having good community partners in this work?
I do believe that good community partners are very important. You know, I've been doing this work for almost 21 years, and I can tell you that the relationships that we have been able to build within our community that fosters that support for victims is important, namely law enforcement. Having that resource, having law enforcement that have the Start by Believing campaign, that are vocal in their support for victims, who are there to listen and offer that option and resource, is important and impactful for victims. We have multiple collaborations within the community with other nonprofits that are there to support, whether it be financial, assist with additional counseling. It's so helpful to have that. We have that with YSS. I know that we have great support through our United Way. Oftentimes, it's helping and assist victims in just navigating the resources and finding Access. So having the collaborations within the community, excuse me, to assist and believe victims, assist victims in making the reports, assisting victims in finding the services, navigating their way to Access so that we can work through the community to support them as well.
Thank you, Lynn. George Bellitzos described the social climate in the 1970s in Ames, and it was during these years that a volunteer group of forward-thinking people got together to form what was then called the Mid-Iowa Rape Crisis Center. They did this before the organization we now know as Access was created, and they were the forerunners, forging the conceptual foundation that made Access possible. This group of people met at the YWCA on campus and used a suicide crisis line to double up as a rape hotline to reach people who had experienced sexual violence. They also tried to generate public attention to this issue. A woman named Mary Ellen Stone led this volunteer group, the Mid-Iowa Rape Crisis Center. We wanted you to hear her describe in her own words what those days were like, partly to illustrate the bravery that was needed and partly to help us all appreciate what we have today.
What's hard to overstate now is what a foreign idea this was in Ames. We were going against a grain, so there was just automatically, for the most part, a lot of resistance. It felt overwhelming and I think just a little daunting about putting myself out there like that, because it raises a lot of personal questions, a lot of defensiveness, because the attitudes were so disbelieving that sexual assault was such an issue. I mean, we didn't know what we were doing, right? Which was fine, but because we just sort of launched ourselves into this, and I would say that you don't know what you're doing doesn't mean you shouldn't try it. And I think that's what we were doing. And I think at times it just felt like there was very little support by way of just recognition that this was make sense. It was not a particularly welcoming discussion in most of Ames. It was just sort of the lack of any affirmation that became really difficult. I remember doing a lot of media interviews just talking about sexual assault, talking about what we were trying to do, and that did help us generate a little bit more momentum to the extent that we had more victims coming forward to show that, I mean, we're not just sort of making this up.
That was Mary Ellen Stone, leader of the Mid-Iowa Rape Crisis Center, a group of volunteers who were essentially the forerunners of the organization that we now know as Access. In addition to the skepticism they faced, they were really up against impossible odds without paid staff or an incorporated organization. The difficulty and complexity of this work requires those things. Eventually, Mary Ellen and Ursula found each other and worked together to hand this effort over to the process of incorporating an organization, which is now known as Access. And do you ever feel like Mary Ellen did in the 70s? Like you don't know exactly what you're doing, but you know that you need to keep trying and keep pushing forward?
I think that that's exactly what victim advocacy feels like. You know, one of the things that I try to impart in the volunteers and interns as they begin this journey is that you will never be the expert. The experts, honestly, are the victims and survivors that we work with, and we learn from them every day. It is not something that I think is an overnight fix. You can't take the course. You can't have all the knowledge. You need to keep striving to build that knowledge and continue to work and learn and push forward. I do think we've made great strides. I think there's wonderful advantages that weren't necessarily there in the 70s, but I don't think we can take that for granted, and I don't think we should ever stop trying.
Lynn, how do you know that you need to keep pushing despite community backlash, and how do you know that you've made the right decision?
I think it's always something that we have to remember is that it needs to be victim-survivor centered. If I'm making a decision, if I'm moving forward, if I'm speaking, I need to remember who and why I'm speaking. And it's for the victims. It's for the survivors. You know, we work very often in what I call the gray. There's not necessarily clear black and white, yes or no, one, two, three. This is the steps you take. But there are always ways that you can make a difference and move forward. There's always something that you can do. And if you do that with the victim first, I think that's the model that helps you to guide you in the right decisions.
Thank you for joining us to comment today, Lynn, volunteer and intern coordinator.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to combine the voices from Access Past with yours as current staff at Access.
And thank you, Courtney Palmerchon, for coming here and sharing this history project with us. And we're talking with Courtney Palmerchon and Lynn Koch from Access, who are exploring the history of Access, which is something near and dear to my heart because I was there at the beginning. So it's kind of a moment to reflect upon my life, too. Lynn, you mentioned that, you know, the struggle to, in a way, I don't think justify is the right word, but to somehow, you know, feel community support for this kind of work never really completely feels completely solid, that it, there's always a sense of having to forge into territory that's difficult to face. Do you find today that Access is able to get more volunteers and interns than in the than it might have in the past, since you're the volunteer and intern coordinator, right?
Yes.
How is it today getting volunteers to work there?
I do think that it is easier in the sense because the language is there, the conversations are in the community and in the education support systems, so people are reaching out first, because they're wanting to make that difference. They're wanting to have a voice in the work that we do. They're wanting to feel that they're making that difference and providing a service that matters and follows the passions that they have. So it is easier. I do think that the other piece of that is that it's also not pretty work. It's harder work. It's not soft and cuddly work. So it poses those struggles in the sense that, yes, we work with victims, all victims of from children to elderly. But it doesn't have that soft, cozy focus. It's not the feel good at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's more kind of like feel disturbed by the end of the day, right?
Right, because there's always more work to do, which isn't a bad thing, but you can't call yourself complete. It's not done. Yes, you've completed this activity. You've brought this awareness. You're providing a service. One of the things that I think is so very important is very early in my journey in this work, I was asked, what's important if you only have 10 minutes? Quite frankly, the 10 minutes is what's important. It isn't what happens after the 10 minutes, but it happens within the 10 minutes, and then the next 10 minutes, and the next hour, and the next day. So it's building on what we have and what we can give and how we show the support. And it's not going to end, and it shouldn't end. I would love to say that it could end, but it will end when violence ends, and I'm not sure that we're there yet. So I think the support needs to continue, and it's a good feeling to provide that support, but it's also a springboard because you need to continue that support.
Yeah, it's very hard work, and yet people do volunteer to do that work. About right at Access?
Yes, we have wonderful volunteers and interns. We couldn't do the work we're doing without that support. Anything from clerical support to providing support through our crisis lines, assisting with that one-on-one peer counseling, support through the court system, providing that education and awareness. That is huge. We need the support that we get from our volunteers. And I'm so grateful and energized every day that I work with them.
About how many volunteers does Access have today?
That varies. Unfortunately, because of COVID, we've had to shift how we use our volunteers and interns. But we have well over 300 to 1,500 hours of volunteer hours yearly. And they're utilized throughout our agency. Because we're doing a lot of our services virtually, it's enabled our volunteers and interns to provide that support to the agency. We've had some that have provided the support last semester when they were out of state, but they were still able to provide that support.
And Courtney, you're an intern at Access. You've been there for 2 years now, right?
Yeah, I started as an intern 2 years ago and then transitioned to full-time about 1 year ago. So I know what it's like being in those shoes, yep.
So what brought you to Access? Why did you choose this type of internship?
Just because this is something that in my personal life I have connections to and that I'm passionate about. So when I saw that I could tie that to my professional work, it just seemed like the perfect fit.
Uh-huh. And do you ever find that you come up against that sense that Mary Ellen had, that you're pushing against, you're pushing a topic that people would rather not hear about?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I, like Lena said, like we've made so many strides, and there are some people that are so open to that conversation, so ready to learn and make changes, but you definitely come across some groups or some people that just aren't ready to hear it quite yet and just need a little more work to be done.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thank you. We're speaking about the work at Access, and I don't know if you remember this, Courtney, but Lynn, I remember one of the when we were speaking with Mary Ellen Stone, who we heard from just recently, talking about how in the beginning nobody really wanted to hear about rape and sexual assault back in the 1970s. When we were interviewing her, she mentioned that she works now in Washington State at a rape crisis center and a sexual abuse center. And she mentioned that in the state of Washington, one of the airlines, and I don't remember which one it was, but one of the airlines, which is based in Washington, had agreed to make it part of their routine announcement at the beginning of the flight that if anybody in the airplane experienced something that they felt was an inappropriate advance on the airplane, that they should report it to the stewardesses and the flight attendants. And I thought that was really interesting. That's kind of taking it to the next level, right? It's taking it beyond just justifying the existence of a center to deal with sexual abuse, but it's really beginning to make it part of the public conversation.
I like that they also normalized that it could happen, and it could happen anywhere, and it could happen to anyone.
That's right. It normalizes it. So it's really kind of taking it the next step so that someday perhaps it won't take as much bravery to talk about the topic as it does now.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you both for the work you're doing and for being today's leaders in this area. I've long since stopped working in the field, and so I am very, very appreciative that both you, Courtney, and Lynn have picked up the baton and, you know, keep doing the work, and really appreciate it. And we've been speaking about the history of ACCESS, and which is the sexual abuse and violence and domestic violence care center in our area. Courtney, tell us again exactly how you can find the project online. You're going to be posting a lot of the oral histories that we've recorded on your website, right?
Yep. So you can find all of that on our website, which is assaultcarecenter.org. And then you can also like and follow our Facebook page, which is at Assault Care Center, because we started on February 1st and it goes till March 17th, 45 days. We'll be posting short snippets of our stories and peeks into our past and future just to celebrate our 45th anniversary. And so, yep, Facebook, our website, assaultcarecenter.org, and also our YouTube channel, Assault Care Center. You can find our project in all three of those places.
Yeah, and I think we must have interviewed maybe, I don't know, at least 20 people, if not more, right?
Yeah, I was going to say somewhere in the ballpark of 15 to 20, maybe more.
yeah, and very, very interesting stories, anywhere from people who were dealing in the upper management and the decision-making of how the organization was built to people who were volunteering there as advocates or as people working, like staying there overnight to help kind of be in charge of the house there where people were living. And so not only do you really learn a lot about the emotional growth experience of working with advocacy, you also learn, at least I learned, how an organization is built, you know, what decisions have to be made along the road in this particular community to keep the organization growing. It's very interesting, the different phases that you go through, right?
We really kind of got a good...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say we got a good thread of the story. We really got a good, like, this is how it started, this is the middle, this is where we're at now. So it was really cool. It is really cool.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. And the other beautiful aspect of this is that women's history tends to be erased in our culture. And this is a really beautiful thing that you're really taking the care, that this organization is taking the care to document its history and give it a place, keep the story alive, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so just one more time, tell us the name of the website. And tell us again how ACCESS can be reached if you need help, if you, the listener, know somebody or yourself need help with sexual assault, rape, domestic violence, or any other type of violence, right?
Yeah, so we have 24/7 helplines that you can call any time of day, and you'll get connected to an advocate who will be able to help you through your situation. I'll go ahead and list those helplines now. Our sexual abuse line is 515-292-5378. Our domestic abuse and homicide violent crime line is 515-292-0519. And our housing line is 515-292-0543. And then we also launched a live chat line on our website. It's up in the upper right-hand corner of our website, assaultcarecenter.org. You can click on that and just live chat with an advocate from Monday through Friday, 9 to 2. So that's a new way of reaching out that we also have now as well.
Okay. And again, the name, the website, tell it, give it one more time.
Assaultcarecenter.org.
Okay. And the all those phone numbers are on the website, and we'll also post them at khoyfm.org on our homepage, along with the audio from this show. So thank you for coming. It's been a pleasure to partner with Access to celebrate this history. And this has been the second of three presentations from Access, the Assault Care Center Sheltering and Support, honoring their 45th anniversary. And we'll be having one more installment exploring one other aspect of the history of Access. It's really a proud local success story that has really involved a tremendous amount of people from our community. It's really been a community effort in every sense of the word. So thank you so much. I've been speaking with Courtney Palmersheim, who is the development director for Access and also the producer of this history project, and Lynn Koch, who is the coordinator for interns and volunteers. Thank you both so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. And thank you for starting out.
Do I blend? No, I don't blend. I am a misfit from the island, like a cardinal in the snow. Do I bleed? Hell yeah, I bleed. When you cut me so deep, looks like a cardinal in the snow. So swallow down your words with a sight of crow. There are things about me that you don't know. Fiercely love. You want a cardinal, not a dove. I am a cardinal, not a dove. Come on. No, I don't bend. I will defend my little island like a cardinal in the snow. So swallow down your words with a sight of crow. There are things about me that you don't. No, not a dove. You want a cardinal, not a dove.
was My Girl the River with another Cardinal in the Snow. I'm Ursula Rudenberg here on KHOI Community Radio. This is Local Talk. And Anna Banana, I think, has been able to join us. Hi, Anna.
Yep, it's Anna Banana here to start our week with a heart-to-heart message on this Monday. So this past Saturday on KHOI, we had a heart-to-heart messages special edition, a poetry and prose edition, where we have our writers from England, California, and Iowa joining a conversation about poetry and prose. So that's Kate Walton, Kara Pluckrose, Rebecca Christian, Professor Raymond Opsfeld, Claire Steele, and John D. Thompson. And they had a lively discussion about the inauguration poem by youth poet laureate Amanda Gorman. So the hill we climb was discussed and whether or not this was a good poem or not. So if you can check out KHOI's Facebook page to see that very, very lively discussion. But for this heart-to-heart message, as Local Talk was, you know, when I started on Local Talk, it was a COVID-19 response. And I found this Amanda Gorman's poem that she wrote in April 2020 that was performed for the program CBS This Morning at the Los Angeles Central Public Library to offer comfort and courage at the start of the coronavirus pandemic. And I think, oh my gosh, we're all the way into almost a year of being in this global pandemic. So this is Amanda Gorman's poem that she again read last year. I thought I'd awaken to a world in mourning, heavy clouds crowding, a society storming. But there's something different on this golden morning, something magical in the sunlight, wide and warming. I see a dad with a stroller taking a jog across the street. A bright-eyed girl chases her dog. A grandma on her porch fingers her rosaries. She grins as her young neighbor brings her groceries. While we might feel small, separate, and all alone, our people have never been more closely tethered. The question isn't if we will weather this unknown, but how we will weather this unknown together. So on this meaningful morn, we mourn and we mend. Like light, we can't be broken, even when we bend. As one, we will defeat both despair and disease. We stand with healthcare heroes and all employees, with families, libraries, schools, waiters, artists, businesses, restaurants, and hospitals hit hardest. We not night in the light, but in lack thereof. For it is in loss that we truly learn to love. In this chaos, we will discover clarity. In suffering, we must find solidarity. For it's our grief that gives us our gratitude, shows us how to find hope if we ever lose it. So ensure that this ache wasn't endured in vain. Do not ignore the pain. Give it purpose. Use it. Read children's books. Dance alone to DJ music. Know that this distance will make our hearts grow fonder. From a wave of woes, our world will emerge stronger. We'll observe how the burdens braved by humankind are also the moments that make us humankind. Let every dawn find us courageous, brought closer, heeding this light before the fight is over. When this ends, we'll smile sweetly, finally seeing, in testing times, we became the best of beings. And I think this poem certainly underlines and illustrates why Amanda Gorman is being praised and celebrated in her talent. But again, you can go to KHOI's Facebook page to see the discussion among the writers about the quality and the what makes a poem good. Also, in the same day, John D. Thompson, who's a writer, and he wrote a book which is 175 poems in celebration of Iowa. And he shared his favorite poem by a modern poet, The Winged Horse by Louise Gluck is attached. And he loves this poem because it's a call and a showcase to creativity and abstract thought. Gluck names something very concrete, a horse, abstraction, and the extended metaphor winds beautifully through the poem. So this is John D. Thompson's favorite poem that he is celebrating in February, which is The Winged Horse. Here is my horse, abstraction, silver white, color of the page of the unwritten. Come, abstraction, by will out of demonic ambition, carry me lightly into the regions of the immortal. I am weary of my other mount, by instinct out of reality, color of dust, of disappointment, notwithstanding the saddle that went with him and the bronze spurs, the bit of indestructible metal. I am weary of the world's gifts, the world's stipulated limits, and I am weary of being opposed and weary of being constantly contradicted by the material as by a massive wall where all I say can be checked up on. Then come, abstraction, take me where you have taken so many others, far from here, to void the star pasture, bear me quickly, dream out of blind hope. And again, there was a lively discussion about John D. Thompson's poem as well that he brought forth. And so I do love that first Saturday of the month. Now it is time for Anna Banana to split. So until next time, I hope that your days are connected to a community of love, care, and support that is KHOI, the heart of Iowa, which is you and me. So back to you, Ursula.
Thank you, Anna. And you've been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, and I'm here with Anna Banana. Thank you for listening. Also, remember you can hear a recording of the show later today at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard on the program. Beginning last Monday and continuing on now at 7 p.m., KHOI is pleased to introduce a new program called Capital Week, which will feature Laura Bellum, author of the Bleeding Heartland blog. It is hosted by KHOI's newsman, Dennis Hart. Ms. Bellum will provide updates on developments at the Iowa State Capitol every Monday night in an in-depth look at the week's legislative actions, government agencies, the governor, and other events that affect local government. Laura Bellum is a highly respected political reporter, and Dennis Hart has been doing the news here at KHOI for several years on a volunteer basis after a long and distinguished career as a journalist and journalism teacher himself. So KHOI will be featuring this new segment every Monday night at 7 o'clock. And from 7:30 to 8 p.m., there will be reports and recordings from forums from other civic organizations. And tonight, you will be hearing the legislative wake-up from the League of Women Voters that happened last weekend. Thank you for listening, and remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you again on the radio.